Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and I'm here with my guest co-host, Dave Cushing. Good morning, Dave.
Hello there, Lynn. Nice to be with you on another program.
That's right. Well, our first guest this morning is Zakiya Tomlinson. This woman is a robotic systems engineer for the Restore-L project at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, which leads the TDM, which is Technology Demonstration Mission project for the agency. Now, Restore-L will flight test a robotic spacecraft in low Earth orbit in 2020, demonstrating autonomous, read, self-driving, on-orbit satellite rendezvous and grasping and telerobotics-enabled refueling and satellite repositioning. That was a mouthful.
That's a lot of adjectives in a row.
Yeah, and I'm dying to know what grasping is, so we'll find out. This is a government-owned Landsat 7 that will serve as this client satellite, the subject of its in-space maneuvers. We look forward to that conversation with Zakiya.
That should be super fascinating, as will our chat with our second guest this morning, Drew Urgot. He is the newly appointed design director of the Leonardo Museum down by the Salt Lake City Library. We'll be talking with Drew about the exhibits in general at this amazing place, as well as a couple new things that are coming online in December, namely the Tech Take Apart and the City Blocks.
Yes.
Exhibits.
That'll be nice.
I think so.
Drew is new to the Leonardo Museum, and we look forward to speaking with him. These two guests, plus today's cool story, when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is newly renovated and located in the historic Golden Rule building at 350 Main Street. We are open nightly at 5:30 p.m. and serve eclectic American cuisine. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my guest co-host Dave Cushing. Our first guest this morning is Zakiya Tomlinson. She is a robotic systems engineer for the Restore-L project. This is taking place at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Now, this leads the TDM, which is Technology Demonstration Mission Project for the agency. This is a project that's developing a 7 degree of freedom robot arm that can be used on missions as diverse as on-orbit satellite servicing, you know, refueling, repositioning satellites. It's a wild world out there, what NASA is doing, and specifically what our guest does for a living, a robotic systems engineer, Zakiya Tomlinson. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. We have so many questions for you. You know, there are so many things, and you probably know this from being at cocktail parties with people, so many things that we take for granted that NASA does. We know there are satellites out there, but we've probably never considered how they get serviced. So maybe you could start with that.
Sure. So actually, right now, satellites don't get serviced. If they are running out of fuel or something gets broken, they will be abandoned and replaced by another spacecraft. And so that's what we're working towards, the technologies that we'll need to be able to, and if there's only a small problem with a spacecraft, to keep it running longer and extend its mission.
And so when a satellite is running out of fuel, In the case of some of the satellites you're going to be working on, they went into orbit. They've been in orbit for 10, 15 years, and they went up with about, well, not much fuel. So when they're decommissioned, do they just then fall into the ocean somewhere and lay at the bottom of the ocean floor?
That's the nominal plan. If they knew that the satellite was going to be reaching its end of life, that they'll bring it down out of its orbit and eventually it will re-enter the atmosphere. Of course, there are also times where there's an unexpected failure and we have no control over the spacecraft of being able to bring it down, you know, in its intended location. And so that's another case where we would be able to help of being able to repair these systems.
All right. So the name of the project you're working on is Restore L, and L stands for Landsat, I was reading, which is, I guess, one of the imagery satellites up there. But what is this device in space? Is it a spaceship? Is it a space capsule? Is it self-propelled? Does it come back to Earth? Tell us about the Restore L unit.
Robot.
Yeah.
So we would be launching with a spacecraft that would have two robotic arms, as well as all of the tools that we would need, and a fuel tank that we would use to refuel Landsat spacecraft. And so we would use our spacecraft to use the robotic arm to grab Landsat, bring the two vehicles together, and then grab the tools that we need to get to work on refueling.
Right. And your spacecraft is called what specifically? Just to clarify.
I guess the servicing, servicing spacecraft.
All right. And that goes up on top of a rocket and detaches like a satellite, but then it has its own control that you run from the ground and you can take it to different parking spots in space, basically?
Correct.
Yeah. All right. And then and it has a fuel tank. And so was the Landsat designed to be refueled from space?
No, it was not. There's actually only two things in space that were designed to be serviced once they were in orbit, Hubble and the International Space Station. So out of the over 1,000 spacecraft satellites, other satellites that are up there, they're not designed to be serviced. And so that's why there's a lot of technology development that has to be done in order to make this happen.
And so is part of your mission to somehow reconfigure these satellites that were built, 15, 20, 25 years ago to be able to be serviced?
It's more along the lines of we have to be very creative in designing our tools to be able to attach on to, grab onto what we need to, remove blanketing that's covering different areas and things along those lines. At the same time, we are working with satellite manufacturers so that future spacecraft would have more friendly interfaces for our robots to work with.
Right. So the services that you will provide with this robotic arm to these satellites, one is refueling. Another one is repositioning. So that's currently not something that can be done, the repositioning. Well, just talk about that a little bit.
While the spacecraft are joined, you could use the engine that's on the spacecraft we've launched to be able to change the orbit of the entire stack of both spacecraft together to lift the aging spacecraft back higher up so that it has more time before it just drifts back down to the Earth.
Well, the fuel that you're going to put on the Landsat 7, is that used? Well, tell me what fuel is used for on a satellite, because I never really thought about it.
Primarily for maneuvering. All the time, we have people on the ground who are watching for if there's any debris that's near spacecraft that we have in orbit, so they can maneuver, change their orbit slightly to avoid coming into contact and getting damage. Also, sometimes there are special, for Earth-observing satellites, there are special things on the planet that they want to observe, say if there's a volcanic eruption or fires. And so they'll use the maneuvering fuel to slightly change how the spacecraft is pointing to make sure that they can get the pictures of what they want.
I see. So since it's a small amount of fuel, it's just these slight deviations rather than lifting it up hundreds of miles to a new orbital place, right? Yeah, I get it. Okay. And besides refueling, what other things might you work on?
So in the future, there's the potential that, spacecrafts could be designed that parts of their instruments or other hardware that's on board could be something that the robot could grab onto and remove and replace with a new component so that you could upgrade the hardware or the instruments, the technology that's on board.
Right. I was reading about the Landsat 7, and it has a downlink of, I think I read 150 megabits per second, which was probably a lot at the time in 1999, but that could be a part on a future satellite where, oh, we want a faster data link so we could send something up and do that. Did I get the idea right, sort of?
Along those lines, also, if there's, you know, the cameras or other instruments that are on board, batteries, another thing over time that could degrade. So those are all items that potentially could be serviced.
How about that? Again, because we take these things for granted, what NASA does, I have no idea how many satellites are out there that belong to NASA, let alone space endeavors from in the rest of the world. How many satellites do we have?
I'm not sure actually how many NASA specifically has, but there's about 1,500 total in orbit from countries all over the world.
Right. And the orbits range from, you know, how many miles away from Earth out into space?
Low Earth orbit is a couple hundred miles up to, you know, geostationary, which is, you know, thousands of miles. So there's a big range depending on the purpose of the satellite.
So we have a picture of you here, and we can hear your voice. You're a very young woman, and I'm just really curious about, you know, there's so much that we're doing now to try to encourage young women towards towards engineering, towards robotics. And could you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in it and where you did your schooling?
Sure. I guess I've been involved in engineering since I was a very young child. I loved, you know, playing with Legos or building things, designing things around my house. I was in a magnet program in high school that one of my teachers entered us in a robotics competition, and that was how I got my start in robotics as a senior in high school. I went to the University of Maryland in College Park for undergrad and worked at a robotics lab there, and then I got a master's of science in aerospace from MIT. Also, my research there was relating to how people understand their environment when they're controlling a robot. That helped me get a position as an instructor for the robotic arm on the space station when I graduated from school.
Yeah, that's really something. That's your earthly background. Now back to space. I want to know more about this Restore 7 craft. Once that's up, can that come back to Earth and be used again?
So the Restore spacecraft will not be reused once it comes back, but there's once we've finished the main portion of the mission with Landsat 7, there's also time that we can use to, you know, be able to test out different technologies and different maneuvers with the robot to help us with future missions after the fact.
And so it will then be in space until it runs out of fuel and needs to be brought down?
It'll have a planned deorbit once it reaches the end of the tasks that are planned for it.
Right. So your goal is to get this launched in 2020. So that's two, 3 years away, right? And then is there a follow-on project for the next generation of Restore-type satellites?
There isn't anything that's set right now. Kind of the next future focus that we're working on is being able to have, you know, future spacecraft designed with more easier interfaces for us to work with. And so we're doing a lot of design work and working with satellite manufacturers for that right now. They definitely see that servicing is the future, and so they want to do what they can to make that easier and make their product more appealing.
I realize that you're an engineer. You're not in the accounting department at NASA, but this must present some huge cost savings if eventually you're able to go up and just service the satellites instead of decommissioning them. Do you know anything about those kinds of numbers?
I don't know the specific numbers, but that is part of the goal of being, you know, especially if you have a mission. Say that something has gone wrong very early and you spent a lot of time and money on that spacecraft in the first place, it would definitely help if you can salvage it rather than having to start all over again developing a replacement for it.
Yeah, and I would imagine that it varies somewhat, but what is the lifespan of a satellite that's in orbit?
It definitely varies. Landsat 7 has been up since 1999. And I think its predecessor had lasted from the early 90s until about 2013, I believe. So, I mean, you know, more than 20 years is can be the lifespan for some spacecraft. Some of them, depending on what their mission goal is, might have a much shorter lifespan.
And what are the some of the things that the Landsat program have brought those of us here on the ground?
Imagery of the Earth is their main goal, and that the Landsat program in general has been taking pictures, I think, for almost 50 years now of our planet. Besides helping out with things like Google Maps, the data lets us show how features on our planet have changed over time, such as erosion. It allows us to see when we have natural disasters on the planet, how the landscape has been changed. So it really helps with our understanding of what's happening on the Earth.
Right, and so Google is one mapping source, pretty popular, I understand, and there's other ones as well. Do they all rely on the same satellite imagery?
There are multiple satellites that are Earth observing, so they can get their data from different sources, and the Landsat data is one that's available to the.
Oh, what are some of the other ones, and are they run by NASA as well?
Not all of them, and there are other countries as well that also have spacecraft that are doing imaging.
Yeah, and so how does the sharing of information between countries work, for example, between NASA and, say, Russia's satellite program?
There are arrangements that are worked out for different missions, and kind of each circumstance, I guess, has its own limitations. And, I mean, we work with the Russians, the Europeans, the Japanese. There are several different agencies around the world that we are working with on many different missions.
So we talk to NASA every now and again, and we just love to host them on this program, Cool Science Radio, and find out, you know, some of these amazing things that you're doing. And one of the recent interviews, you know, we talk about satellites that are allowing a different version, a different look at weather patterns. And you talked about some of the disasters that go on, natural disasters that go on around the Earth. And the increasing need for this type of imagery as climate change is, you know, we're seeing more extreme weather events, fires, floods, things like that. And in your particular work, do you work with these types of satellites as well?
Not directly. I mean, one of the big things that we're going to be taking advantage of during this mission is other communication satellites. In order to be able to get our data back and forth to our spacecraft, we will be controlling the robotic arms from the ground, and so it's very important to have that communications link as much, you know, as constantly as possible throughout the mission.
Right. So do you have a metric of, like, a probability of success, and does that change over time, and what's it sitting at now? What are your hopes for this, and what are the chances it might not work?
I mean, I think one of the things that probably would affect our success is just our knowledge of the unknowns. So we do as much as we can beforehand to study every detail that we can about the spacecraft that was launched, you know, 20 years ago, finding all the information we can so that we know as much as possible, and we can design everything, you know, as detailed as we can to make sure that we are successful.
Right. So I'm assuming you have a live mock-up of the Landsat 7 in your lab with the robotic arm so you can design the tools to peel away the skin or whatever you got to do. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah, that's actually a large portion of my job is working with the folks who have designed our tools, test out what they've done, figure out what improvements need to get made, and, you know, the iterative process there of making sure that design is as good as we can make it.
And when you finally get that skin peeled back or whatever you do, however you want to describe it, you'll eventually see a valve that was originally used to put fuel in the tank, I'm guessing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then you have to have the right thing to and the right force to get it in there in a weightless environment. That sounds pretty.
What a challenge.
Yes.
So you got to grab it from behind or somehow secure it so it doesn't go away, and then insert the fuel in and hope it transfers through. That's just something. What are you working on this afternoon?
excuse me, working on some of our different tools for actually kind of on another technology mission that we have, working with the International Space Station to make sure that all these techniques and everything are you know, as perfect as we can get them before we get to the Restore L mission. So we're developing procedures and doing our testing on the ground. And then we also have some testing in space before we get to the real mission.
Right. If you're just joining us, our guest is Zakiya Tomlinson. She is a robotics systems engineer at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. She's working on the Restore-L project, which is going to be a robotic arm or two that will help to service the satellites that are land imagery satellites, the Landsat-7 program. This is just, it's so enlightening and illuminating to even consider a project like this, and the work that you're doing. And you know, back to your education, you're getting your master's degree at MIT. Did you imagine? Well, at that point, you imagined that you wanted to be in aerospace because that was a specialty of your master's, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, but did you have hopes? What were your greatest aspirations? Did you imagine you'd be working on something like this?
No, not at the time. I didn't even know really that. I think a lot of people didn't really know that this was going to be where as our heritage in the Hubble servicing missions was going to take us to doing, you know, servicing missions without the astronauts and just using the robotic arms. But I knew at the time that I definitely, you know, was really interested in robotics. In space and seeing how far we can push the technology to new missions and new ventures.
And so other than the fact that there's no gravity in space, and that is another element that's I know at NASA you know how to work with this at this point, but it is a component of the work you do that is different than any other type of systems engineering that you could be doing here on Earth. What are there other elements that we wouldn't imagine that you would have to deal with working in space, designing a robot for space?
Temperature is one of the other considerations. It goes from being very, very hot in the sun to very, very cold in the shade, and designing systems that are capable of surviving and working reliably in a large range of conditions. Lighting is another one, and we work with that in our lab. Of the side of the spacecraft we'll be working with isn't in sun. So we have to bring all of our lights, everything that we need to be able to see what we're doing along with us, and testing out to make sure that that's actually going to work as well as we need to, that we can see the details. The material that the spacecraft is covered in is very shiny, so that adds another challenge when you have the light shining on it, that it's hard to differentiate what you're looking at in some cases.
Right.
So there's a lot of things that we test out now to hopefully make sure we're prepared later.
So I'm picturing these robotic arms, and you know, you talk about temperature gradient and being very hot, then very cold, and these things have joints, and therefore they need to have lubrication. I mean, even coming up with something as simple as a lubricant that's going to work both in, you know, in these very extreme temperatures it just kind of blows my mind.
There's a lot of very smart people going and working on the design.
And some of the lubricants for space have been implemented on the space station and other places, right? Because they've had robotic mm-hmm. arms for a while. So you draw on their work, no doubt.
Yes, the space station, Mars rovers, there's several different space applications for robotics that we're trying to learn from the lessons that they've learned and help us with our design.
So when's your personal trip to the International Space Station?
Oh, that would be fantastic. Not on the schedule quite yet.
Well, maybe. Hey, let's talk about SpaceX, because, you know, they've come up out of the blue and, well, not the blue, but in the last 10 years, they've proven some amazing technologies at low cost that can get things into space and back, and NASA contracts with them and so do other countries. Is there a role that you know of that SpaceX is looking into or playing in the restore area?
They actually have a role in the very near future with us, that they're carrying one of our payloads up to the International Space Station that we'll use as a test bed. So that's something in the very short term that we're working with on them. I'm not entirely sure for the longer term, but that is potentially something in the future that might be possible.
And I suppose someone like you would watch with great interest on, you know, these efforts, because we've been watching this as SpaceX using the technology to bring the craft back to a landing platform in the ocean. And, you know, each time they've gotten a little bit closer, but So far, I believe they've managed to lose the spacecraft each time. Is that right? I mean, it because it doesn't land quite on the platform.
I believe they had at least one successful water landing, and they definitely had landings back down near the launch pad as well. So they have had some success.
Yeah.
Super interesting. What about the Jeff Bezos space project? What's that one called? Crystal Blue? Anyway, are they anywhere near
the
commercialization?
Amazon?
Do you know?
I don't know a lot about their program.
It must be fascinating to work for NASA and seeing all these private entities coming up, like SpaceX, to contribute to the work that you do, to be more fluid in their ability to sort of maneuver in a business environment in the private sector. Do you at NASA, do scientists, look forward? They must look forward at the same time. They must feel threatened a bit from time to time by these private entities.
I think, as you have anywhere, that everyone has their own opinions for different things. But, I mean, it's definitely all a lot of folks, working towards the same goal. I think it's an important thing to try and keep in mind. And so hopefully, we can all get there together.
Hey, last question maybe is at your facility. By the way, where are you in the Baltimore area?
Just outside of Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. Do school groups come in and get to spend some time in your environment and see what goes on there?
Yes, we have schools that come on tours, and we also do virtual tours using an iPad, and so we can do tours for schools that can't travel. We've had some, as far as Ecuador, that we've been able to share the work that we're doing and hopefully inspire them to follow along in our footsteps.
Wow, so if our local science teachers wanted to arrange something that virtually, how would they reach out?
It's on our website that we have the ability to contact to make the arrangement.
Could you mention the name of the website? Is it part of NASA.gov?
Yep, it's sspd.gsfc.nasa.gov. GSFC, Goddard Space Flight Center.
Oh, yeah.
.nasa.gov.
Wonderful.
Fantastic.
Well, Zakiya, I'm so glad that you could join us today. This is great work that you're doing. Zakiya Tomlinson is a robotic systems engineer working at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. And this photo that we have of you is you standing in front of the robot that you're working on in the lab there. So testing the work that you're doing. What a great job you have.
It's a lot of fun. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for your time.
And it's Cool Science Radio. If I had to do it all over again, Dave.
Would you be a space scientist?
I think I might be. I don't know if I've got what it takes. But, you hear, we talk to these scientists from NASA from time to time on this show, and it just blows me away that the work that they're doing and the accomplishment that they must feel within their work.
And they're so personable.
Yeah.
Right. That too.
All right. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. We're going to talk about the Leonardo Museum in Salt Lake City and all the great events going on there. Another place where they do great work. Stay with us. It's Cool Science Radio.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We proudly support KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have been supporting the local community and providing real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. This is your co-host, Dave Cushing, with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest is Drew Ergot. He is design director of the Leonardo Museum in Salt Lake City, right down by the public library. You know, Leonardo da Vinci was an artist, an engineer, a scientist, an architect, a musician, and a humanitarian. And the Leonardo Museum was created to honor and embody the spirit of this Renaissance man. He was the Renaissance man of Renaissance men, I think. Well, Drew is here to tell us about the current exhibits in the museum and a couple special ones that will be unveiled in December. Drew Ergot, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, so basically, as design director, what is your job at the museum?
Well, I get to do what I consider to be all the fun stuff. I get to play with the visual side of the museum, both from the marketing standpoint. I delve into the exhibit design and really just look at the brand and how we communicate it and how we get to, you know, express that through the museum experience.
And you've recently come to the museum?
Yeah, I've been there for about 6 months now.
Oh, yeah. And were you in a design or museum background before?
Yeah, I've been a designer for probably 20 years now.
Oh, yeah.
I actually worked with the Leonardo 6 years ago during their opening, ironically, just working on the wayfinding program and other kind of signage and identification systems throughout the museum. So that's kind of how I got introduced to them and kind of been following them ever since and just really love the place. So
I'm still a newcomer, only 3 years in town, and I haven't even been down to it. But what was the impetus for starting this whole museum, and who was behind it?
As I understand it, there were three entities. There was an art entity, an engineering, and a science entity, all separate groups. And the city had the old library space, and they were looking to do something with it. And it's my understanding that everybody kind of came together, and the city worked and came up with the plan for the Leonardo and kind of said, hey, why don't you guys kind of all come together and do something in this space?
So I've been down there just a few times to see the Body Works exhibit, which is art, science, and a little engineering, I suppose. And then also when they had the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. Mm-hmm. But what are, you know, what are the types of exhibits that you gravitate towards, or what are your favorite ones that are displayed now?
Well, everything we do is kind of a interrelationship of all those different disciplines, right? We try to bring a little science to everything, a little art, a little engineering. Right now, I mean, we were just talking about NASA, right? So we have a flight exhibit right now where, you know, visitors get to do flight simulators. They get to come in and learn about aerodynamics. And we recently got a artifact from Orbital ATK. It's actually part of a spacecraft. It's from the fuel assembly. It's a section of that that component of the ship. And this was like where all the fuel was stored that sent not all, but several missions for NASA into space. So that's a kind of relevant topic.
Yeah. So talk about this artifact. Is it from which mission is it?
I think it's from 12 or 13 total missions. There was some Endeavor missions, some Discovery missions. I think it may have even played a part in Atlantis. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but we do have the full mission log at the museum.
Right. So I was saying to our last guest who works at NASA that we so often take these things for granted. And I would imagine, you know, until we visit a place like the Leonardo Museum, or until we have a conversation with someone from NASA that's working on something like our last guest was, you know, what do you find when either groups of school kids come through or adults that is the most illuminating at the museum? You know, what blows people's minds the most that we might take for granted?
Well, I think that's different for each person, right? I think probably what we hear the most is people really enjoy the C-131 plane that we have inside the building. I don't think people expect to see that. We actually have two planes inside the building. We have a C-131 and a MiG-21.
The C-131 is a four-prop military transport, isn't it? Or is it? Or is that the C-130? I don't know. What is the C-131?
Yeah, it's like a...
Sounds big.
Yeah, it's a cargo plane, and people can come and climb into it. I mean, ours is two-prop, I believe. All so right. I don't know if we've... it went in before I was there, but I'm not sure if we've kind of cut it down or not. But it's really interesting the way it's integrated into the building. I mean, we have like the pillars that support the building kind of coming through the plane. And it's pretty exciting. There's a little slide that comes out the tail end of it. You can kind of go in through stairs and come out through a slide if you want.
And where'd you cop the MiG?
I believe it's a Polish MiG.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a Russian-made fighter.
Yeah, it was a deadly machine. I mean, it has like a 4-to-1 kill ratio. Ours is, it's a pretty impressive machine too. Yeah. Ooh.
Wow. So one of the exhibits you have is the Innovation Showcase and the Jarvik Artificial Heart. I mean, I don't know if you were around. You may be too young to remember when that came out. I don't even remember when it was, but it was such a huge newsmaker,
yeah.
And we all remember the Jarvik Artificial Heart, and you've got that on display.
Yeah, we do. I mean, several components of it are there, different prototypes, and it's, to some degree, it's a little shocking how much it looks like the heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's all the different chambers, and it's made of these resins. It's kind of a ochre color, kind of, and it's cool to see it. I mean, obviously the technology has evolved quite a lot since then, but it's a Utah innovation, and we like to spotlight our locals. So
that's right.
And some of the other local innovations that you have on display include what?
The Atari.
What?
That's the Atari was local. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either until I started working there. I was like, oh yeah. Yeah, let's check that out. Like, we've got a console there and a few of the games. And
Was the company based here, or were the original developers here and then moved to California? Or
I think I'm not 100% sure on that. Yeah, but I think that's actually going back to the earlier question about what's the illuminating moment. I think that's one of the more shocking things people experience when they come in. They're like, oh, I had no clue that the Atari was here. So.
Yeah, and the notes also say the television was. Are we saying the television was invented in Utah? It's on the notes.
I cannot confirm or deny.
It says the Frisbee, too.
The Frisbee, yeah.
The Frisbee is a Utah innovation?
I have a hard time believing that. I mean, wasn't the Frisbee, designed and developed on the beaches of California? Had to be.
I think so, but I don't know. There's a lot of sand here.
Yeah,
we have California seagulls. So
that's true. State bird. So talk about a couple of the exhibits, the Tech Take Apart, for example.
Yeah, so Tech Take Apart is actually part of a rotating program that we have on the floor every second Saturday. It's a kind of an activity where guests can come and spend some time with our resident engineer who takes technology apart and explains how it works. So it's a little educational program, and it's a way to kind of see how things are coming together and how technology makes things, function. Our December one coming up is gonna focus on phones. So we actually got a donation of new phone systems from our friends at OneWire, and they instead of going all office space on the phones and smashing them, we're gonna. Use it as an opportunity to educate our visitors. And
are these desk sets or cell phones?
No, they're desk sets. Oh, yeah, right, so it's got all the switchboard and everything built into it. And it was an old phone system, and we're glad to have a new one. As a nonprofit, it always helps to get some donations.
So. Oh, so you're taking the actual existing one that you use at the Leonardo and decommissioning it for the Tech Take Apart. So I'm sorry, again, that's every Saturday?
Second Saturday.
Every second Saturday
of the month, yeah. And every Saturday we have a rotation. So the first Saturday is a Rube Goldberg chain reaction machine workshop. And the third Saturday is cardboard machines. And the fourth is a winged aerodynamics workshop as well. So it's you know, we try to keep the content fresh on the floor so that each time you come, it's a little bit different. And, you know, you can conceivably come four times a month and mm-hmm. have a different experience.
In the after the take, the tech take apart, do they do a tech put together?
Well, you know, we have a similar program. We had a program, it's called Fix It Clinic.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a little bit akin to Tech Take Apart in a sense that we're people can bring in their broken items and, you know, work with specialists to repair them. And whether that's a sewn good or an electronic piece, or we have different specialists each time. And when we have them scheduled, we post kind of who's going to be there. And you can sign up for a time slot to come get your old item repaired.
Wow.
That sounds cool.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Drew Ergot. He is the design director at the Leonardo Museum in Salt Lake City. That's, of course, I keep saying it's right next to the Salt Lake Library, but what's the actual address?
209 East, 500 South.
Okay. I've got a challenge for you. I actually have thought about how I would like to take a class. I have an old Honda Trail 90. You know those orange, they were orange motorcycles, yellow motorcycles. I know you'd know what it was if you saw it. It's from the early 70s. And it was passed down to me from my father. The one item I inherited.
It's packing a 90cc engine.
Yes, but it's classic. It's just this classic motorcycle. Well, I keep leaving it in the backyard and not running it. And I would love to come and get and learn how to like go through the carburetor and clean it out, because I don't want to have to keep taking it down to the Honda dealership. Is that something that you could, can I bring in my Trail 90?
That would be really cool. That may be a little bit more than the session would allow for. I mean, that's a pretty involved process. You could probably get, I know there'd be people there that could help like get you started on it, but you'd be able to get it up and going and get to bring it in a trailer and cruise away.
Right. Wouldn't that be great though? So I'm better off bringing my Blend Tech blender that has a ball bearing problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But you will,
great.
It is that educational level component. So it's like you are involved in the fixing of the item. It's not just, you know, getting it done and being a passive. It's a much more active experience.
Yeah.
Hey, there's also an exhibit called Perception, the Illusion of Reality. Can you tell us what that is all about?
Certainly. That's actually one of my favorite exhibits. It's being a designer and really focused on aesthetics, perception is kind of all the way we see things and the way our senses work. And there's optical illusions in there, and there's things that kind of play with your hearing and even some of your physical senses as well. There's a component within it where you're like press against walls for a certain amount of time, and when you stop and walk away, your arms will just go into the air all on their own. And there's some kind of fun activities involved with that as well.
Right.
But I love that exhibit.
That's cool. How long is it? Would you want to spend in the Perception exhibit itself?
Well, the whole museum is, I think the average time is probably 2 to 3 hours. So Perception could keep you going for, you know, probably an hour if you're really into it.
Interesting. And what's Leonardo's workshop?
Leonardo's workshop, that's the area where we host like the Tech Take Apart programs and everything.
Okay, yeah.
So it's more of our engineering focus, physics focused area of the museum. We have a like a physics wall where people can drop a marble through a chain of tubes and kind of plot the descent and play with that as well. And there's other just kind of, engineering focused activities and learning opportunities.
You know, the more we talk about this, the more I think about, you know, school kids now, they have a lot of opportunities to partake and be involved in a lot of things that you've been talking about, and I'm sure you get a lot of kids at the museum. But, you know, for those of us that are, you know, decades beyond being a child, what a great opportunity. Because I think, you know, when we were growing up, we didn't have that sort of hands-on opportunity in a museum like the Leonardo. I'm curious about, you know, what you see for, you know, even like you know, the seniors that might come in and do this? What do you see with adults?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously hands-on is a big part of what we do. If you're a curious person and you're really wanting to learn about different things and get your hands kind of involved, that's a great way to do it. But we actually have adult-centered programming as well. You know, people do think of us as a family museum, and it's great for kids. But at the same time, in the evenings, we do like 21-plus events where people can come and hang out and basically experience the museum at night. No children. You get, you know, some food, some drinks, just kind of hang out. It's a fun time. There's live bands. There's all kinds of other activities and you know, a higher energy museum experience. It's not the stand back and look at a painting kind of experience. You know, it's a much more lively thing.
That sounds great. And don't you have one of those coming up? Was it December 14th? I saw something about libations, and I was thinking that that would be some sort of chemistry experiment, but I think it's just drinks while
Well, the libations program is like a food and wine pairing.
Oh, okay.
It's a culinary food program of ours. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It's,
so it is a little chemistry.
Yeah, a little bit. The delicious kind. But yeah, it's a fun little program. We bring in a sommelier who talks about wine and why they're paired with certain foods, and it's kind of a limited seating engagement, and sells out pretty regularly. So it's fun.
So this one is December 14th from 6 to 8, libations at the Leonardo. Holiday favorites. Says.
Yeah. We should go to that.
Well, we should go. Yeah.
That sounds great.
It's a timely
topic. Is it sold out yet?
We can get you in. But no, it's not sold out yet, but tickets just had recently gone on sale for that.
Oh, yeah. Right. Wow. That sounds like a great holiday thing to do. What other holiday sorts of, you know, do you have other holiday twists on things?
Yeah, right now we're actually doing a lot of DIY holiday activities on the floor. So if you come in, there's like ornament making tabletops and other holiday exciting things like that. I'm hoping we can get some like cool gift wrapping techniques going on and other things to just kind of prepare everyone and to unlock your holiday creativity, turn into a little holiday superstar event.
That's kind of great. Is that included with your admission? You can have the materials to make an ornament, or is there maybe a separate charge for that?
I believe that it's included.
Yeah.
There, sometimes we do have little upcharge activities when the materials are a little bit higher end or maybe there wasn't a sponsor involved to help us get the materials pulled together.
But what's the price for adults?
It's $12.95 typically for
kids.
$8.95.
Right. Seniors?
I think it's $8.95 for seniors as well. Yeah.
What a great thing. This sounds, you know, it sounds like just, as I said before, I've come for specific exhibits, but just to go there and be and do some of the do-it-yourself holiday projects would be fun. Bring my Honda Trail 90 in. Yeah. Oh, I mean my blender.
Yeah, bring your blender, Lynn. Yeah. Hey, is there also an upcoming something called City Blocks?
Yeah, so we're looking at, originally we were hoping that would open in December, but it's another original exhibit. So we had Flight, our first large-scale original exhibit. This is a little bit smaller than that, but it's hopefully going to open in January, and it's basically about city planning, the future of the Wasatch Front. We're going to have like Lego replicas of key structures throughout the city, and it's going to be a really fun, engaging exhibit. People are going to be able to like play with the digital software for Lego building and design their own buildings, and there'll be community build opportunities and lots of fun activities planned throughout the, you know, throughout the course and lifespan of the exhibit.
Wow. And how long is the exhibit?
It'll probably run for 6 months or so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And are you looking for actual solutions from Wasatch Front residents?
That'll be part of the programming.
Wouldn't that be great?
At some point there will be, you know, kind of give us your vision of the future.
Yeah, community engagement at its finest.
Totally. Now, you're a hands-on museum by pretty much, but what kind of virtual footprint do you have on either social media or YouTube videos about what you do, or is that part of the outreach of your organization?
I mean, we're on all the typical networks, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, et cetera. We would love to get to the point where we have kind of a virtual museum the entire exhibit or the entire footprint of the museum in a digital experience. We're kind of working on that, but that's a bit of a long road and a big project, but we would love to get to that point.
Mm. Right. Well, the website is theleonardo.org. And, you know, Walter Isaacson just came out with, you know, he's such a great biographer, and he came out with the book, Leonardo, or Leonardo da Vinci, a new biography. Do you have that around the place? I mean, how connected are you to the namesake?
I mean, he's our metaphor, right?
Yes.
We're not a museum about him. We're just about everything that he stood for and how he saw the world. We don't currently have a copy of the book for guests to read, but it's certainly making rotations around the staff.
Yeah.
We're all very engaged in reading that. I haven't started yet, but I do plan on reading it cover to cover. So.
I think as adults, we would all do well. You know, we complain about losing our curiosity, that children have so much natural curiosity, but it seems to be bred out of us as adults. But we would all do well by reading a biography of Leonardo da Vinci to sort of, and stop by the Leonardo Museum to inspire that curiosity that we think we've lost, but it's just there laying dormant, right?
It is. Sort of.
I mean, in some of us more than others.
Yeah, some people take a little bit more coaxing.
Exactly. Hey, before we go, there's something that strikes my fancy on the list of exhibits. It's, see if I pronounce this right, the Hylozoic Veil.
Yes, that...
Did I say that right?
That's a really cool piece.
What is it?
So that's actually been a part of the museum for the entire six-year lifespan. It was there at opening day, and it's there still today. It's a piece by Philip Beasley. He's an architect, and it's kind of a living architecture installation. It's a responsive sculpture, so like it's sensitive to light and movement, and it comes alive and does it. You know, it moves, it flashes lights, it does things in response to your engagement with it. Right now, it's kind of suspended above our escalator. So as you go up the escalators, you're kind of inside or very close to the center point of the installation itself.
And do you interact with it while on the escalator?
Well, I mean, you.
Or does it interact with kinda, you?
Yeah, it kind of responds to you as you pass through the space.
Wow, kind of like a kaleidoscope or something.
Is there any interface between the Leonardo and Burning Man? Or the Utah Burn?
No official partnerships. A lot of us are pretty creative, and some of the staff definitely go and participate.
Right, but, right. Sounds like there'd be natural inclination on both sides there.
Yeah, yeah, but they do. There's fascinating things that happen at that as well.
Yeah. Well, Drew Aragot is the new design director, new-ish design director at the Leonardo Museum in Salt Lake City. We're so glad you could join us today.
I was very happy to join. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining.
Talk to you later.
Let's thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. And thank you, Dave Cushing, for joining me today.
My pleasure. I hope to see you again on another program.
John Wells will be back next week. And stay tuned now. Thanks to our underwriters.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now to head into National Public Radio News from Washington.